So I had to run out of the studio for just a second because I needed to make sure I had something to clean my bug-eyed glasses so that I really made sure that I got every word right on this story on Coast to Coast to get us started this evening. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. And last week, right about this time, we were talking with Peter Ward. Peter Ward is the author of a series of books. He's a wonderful guest. I had a really interesting time with him. We were talking about the possibility of the oil spill being a planet killer, that the Gulf oil spill could create circumstances enough that eventually it might lead to the death of the planet, or what would it take in order for it to become a planet killer? And along the way, we were talking about the subject of methane buildup. And I saw this article came out Wednesday, and we called to ask whether Peter Ward could come back on again, because, you know, when a guest gets it right, a guest gets it right. And I just want to pick up that part of conversation again and amplify it in just a moment before we go forward with any of the other guests, including coming up in just a minute, the new book out by John Robbins. He's the author of the best-selling classic Diet for a New America. He's all about living till we're living well and living until much older than most people would expect they could live, to 100 plus. But his new book is about living better, not just longer, but living better and finding ways to live better through the practice of less, how to make less work out to be more for you. And we'll talk about that. So not just living longer, but living better, the new good life. John Robbins, who knows a little bit about both sides of the conversation, having been an heir to the Baskin-Robbins fortune. And as I understand it, having lost that to Bernie Madoff, but he was living with less before less became fashionable. And we'll get to him coming up a little bit later on this hour. Also, next hour on Coast to Coast, the former Eli Lilly drug executive, who is now telling the world about the ways in which, in his own experience, drug companies practiced a kind of evil, where they are more interested about keeping people sick and on pills, consuming their products, than actually making them better and getting off of their pills. His name is John Viripen, and we'll talk to him coming up next hour. He will reveal the inside secrets of Big Pharma, and how they intentionally keep people sick, so that they can continue to rake in massive profits. This is what he says, and we'll let him explain how he knows this from the inside coming up next hour. But again, that circles me back to what the news was in just a moment that we'll start with, because I wanted to make sure we got it right. Texas A&M University oceanographer professor John Kessler said methane gas levels in some areas are astonishingly high, 100,000 times acceptable levels. In some areas, in some readings, went 1 million times higher, 1 million times higher for methane levels. So what does that mean? Well, we'll go back over that very important part because it may have huge implications for Florida. Coming up next with Dr. Peter Ward, who comes back to pick up part of that conversation once more on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So the article read this: methane in Gulf astonishingly high. That, according to a U.S. scientist, this is a Reuters story, as much as 1 million times the normal level of methane gas has been found in some regions near the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, enough to potentially deplete oxygen and create a dead zone, U.S. scientists said on Tuesday. And of course, that's just when we decided to call Dr. Peter Ward back to the stand of Coast to Coast AM and ask him more about that after a very good time last week. Good evening, Peter.
Hey, how are you doing?
Well, we're doing very well, but help us out with that. First of all, when you were talking about it last week, what was the model you were using for this potential buildup of methane in the Persian Gulf? I mean, in the in the Mexican Gulf. What were you thinking of it? Why did it come up for you?
Yeah, there was a professor from Northwestern University, and his name is Gregory Riskin. And in fact, I think this might have been mentioned on the show Coast to Coast in the middle of the week. He has posited that methane, for instance, in the Black Sea, methane occurs when you have really nasty, low oxygen conditions, and bacteria produce this gas. Methane is highly flammable. The idea is that enough methane is produced under extraordinary circumstances, that a bubble comes out of the sea and lightning hits it and it blows up. So this is always nice and academic, interesting. But here we have a case where oil breaks down into methane. We have these enormous methane concentrations. When I was on your show, I was just going back to just some calculations I'd made on the back of the envelope, and when it came out, I was a little surprised. My calculations were so low compared a million times more than they suspect is scary. I mean, it's just so scary.
So when you said it, and last week we were talking about Dr. Peter Ward's vision of what could happen under certain circumstances from this Gulf oil spill. And also, I mean, that and you were very clear about the book is The Flooded Earth, and your book is really about the melting polar ice caps and stuff, but some of the data still pertains to how you see this situation in the Gulf. When you said this, you said that the methane buildup, the breakdown that could be coming up, this giant methane bubble from starting down from the, you know, below the ocean surface could come up and at one time could create a possibility of, we're one lightning strike away, essentially, from a burning sky?
Yeah, Riskin's calculations were from the Black Sea. What if the whole Black Sea gave off this big bubble of methane? And he posited that you could have a big portion of China burned away. But look, here's the really interesting thing. The ice ages changed from really cold to really warm in as little as 10 to 20 years. How did that happen? And Riskin suggested that these bubbles of methane pop out. Here's why it's so scary. Methane is the most efficient greenhouse gas on the planet. Methane is many times more powerful than carbon dioxide in warming the atmosphere. Look, if we have a million times the methane concentration, even if it doesn't turn into a bubble and blow up, it is going to accelerate global warming at an unbelievable rate. We have this scenario now where the glaciers do melt, where my idea, well, it's not my idea, but certainly this idea that we melt Greenland, we lose Greenland, we have 10 to 20 feet of sea level going up. This methane catastrophe just feeds into that.
Well, but then there was that very specific part of the vision that this methane could ignite from a lightning strike. And if the model is true for Florida, as to what this other professor's model was for China from the Black Sea, then that you could see a big part of Florida, including the people that live there, would come under a very unusual sort of scenario of reduced oxygen and a flammable sky, a burning, like a giant gas explosion, like you would see at like an industrial gas explosion.
Yeah, absolutely. And unusual in the sense that you would kill like a whole lot of people. That would be, I mean, there's the unusualness in this. It's just so scary, Ian, that, I don't know, this hurricane season is coming. We have these offshore permits for many, many, many of these wells. This one time won't do it. But let's say we have 30 or 40 deep water wells and we have a giant super hurricane, which are coming, and they snap off 20 at a time. Then it's not just this one. You have the concentration of oil in that entire area. Well, it begs the imagination.
Well, let's hope it doesn't ever get to that, that we're already learning from this one, and hopefully we won't have this repeated anytime soon, although that's not our human history. We tend to repeat things a couple of times before we finally get it. But then back to what you were saying about the million times greater methane buildups, that if this guy is right, John Kessler, Texas A&M University oceanography professor, if he's right And there's at least, 100,000 times higher than normal in a bunch of different places, and some places may be spiking up to a million times higher. Is there anything we can do about it as a human population? Is there anything we can do to fight that kind of methane buildup? And is there anything that anybody can do to prepare for the possibility that it could just en masse rise up and or become ignited?
Yes, there is something we can do. There's been a number of scientists who have been writing me, a bunch of us over the past 2 weeks, have been worrying more about hydrogen sulfide, that rotten egg smell.
Right.
But the methane and hydrogen sulfide are produced by the same exact mechanism. And there's a man, a petroleum engineer in Calgary, who works for one of the big oil companies. He suggests that we need to pump in fresh salt water. We need to just get unmethaned or unhydrogen sulfide, fresh salt water, pump it down by the well. We need to dilute this stuff, and we have to do it fast.
That's very interesting. Where do we find it?
Well, you just move offshore. I mean, the Atlantic itself, there's plenty of salt water. Get away. The Gulf is like a great big toilet in a way. There's no tides. There's very little circulation. The water is stagnant. It sits there. Just go off the Florida Keys. Go further out to sea. Pump water in and pump it right down around that well, and you fix this thing. Well, you don't fix the oil around it, but you certainly
right.
mediate what's going on with all the methane.
And is anybody, could anybody do this? Does anybody have the technology to pump seawater from that far away to a location such as the Deepwater Horizon?
Oh, sure. We could do this quite quickly, as a matter of fact. This isn't that bad. You could take surface seawater. You just need to get far enough away. You measure the seawater. You find, oh, no methane here. Pump it down around the well. Might take a week to get the gear into place and dilute it. You know,
okay.
this is easy. It's cheap compared to what the consequences could be.
And that's where we'll leave it for now. Let's hope, in a way, that we're not calling you back next week for another update on other things that you predicted that could happen are happening. But at the same time, important to know that you're already on the case and that other people are talking about it and that people can read it and they can debate it for themselves. The Flooded Earth is the new book out by Dr. Peter Ward. And thank you so much for your continued time on Coast to Coast.
Sure. Could I have a last word? I wonder if your listeners know how good you are as an interviewer, because you are good.
Oh, well, you're very nice to say that. Thank
All
you.
Right. That's, Thanks so much.
You can always have that last word. See? The Good New Life is the new book out by John Robbins, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less. First, we got to get our problems fixed. First, it'd be nice if we weren't trying to kill our planet or kill ourselves anyway. Maybe the planet in the end would survive without us after all. But we've got to do better by the Gulf situation, without a doubt. And then we got to decide what it is that we want for ourselves. You know, actually, my wife and I were having this conversation after we were talking about the possibility of rising ocean levels. Dr. Peter Ward was talking last week about possibility that the Greenland ice could melt and oceans could go up 10 feet. Okay, it just sounds crazy. Or that there's an iceberg ice shelf off of Antarctica that continued to break off, would start to melt, and oceans would go up 10 feet. And then what would that mean for all of the shoreline communities, all the cities like Miami, like, you know, New Orleans, like, you know, Houston, Galveston? I mean, cities that depend on being near the ocean, what would happen to them? What would happen to the populations? Everybody would be moving inland, or, you know, a new shore community would be created miles away from where it is now. So we were just talking about that because we've always wanted to retire to a beach somewhere. But then you like, do you invest in property which might not be there? I know it sounds crazy, but do you? And then I thought, well, okay, I want to look at some best case scenarios. So I just sort of put aside the book, The Flooded Earth, and I was just kind of Googling around, seeing what I could come up with. And I think Dr. Ward is right, at least in the sense when he says that some of the most conservative estimates say that the ocean will go up 3 feet in the next 50 to 100 years. That's conservative. Now, maybe that'll change, but what would 3 feet mean to the beachfront property that we hope to pass along to our kids someday? It means we wouldn't be passing that along to our kids someday. We'd be passing along photographs of where the beachfront property used to be, perhaps. So it made us start to think, well, where would we move? What would we do? How would we get by? And in a changing economy still, I thought, well, what is the new good life? And that brings me back to John Robbins, the new good life, living better than ever in an age of less. Not a bad plan to consider. Good evening, John Robbins. How are you?
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, I enjoyed your family's product for years, continued to, although I know it's not something that you're affiliated with anymore. But I think we can't tell your story without telling a little bit of the Baskin Robbins story. So that was your dad and your uncle?
Yes, they were the founders and the co-owners of 31 Flavors.
And to be very proud of that, I think, in a lot of ways, because I love the product. But you were always a little, you were in tension with the product, because even though you liked ice cream, you saw it as an unhealthy product. And as proof of that, you pointed to wasn't the early death of your uncle that made an impression on you?
Yes, the unfortunate, my uncle Bert Baskin, my dad's brother-in-law and partner, and the co-owner of the company, died of a heart attack at the age of 54. And he was a very big man, and he ate a lot of ice cream. And when it happened, I asked my dad if he thought there might be a connection between the amount of ice cream that he would eat and his fatal heart attack. And my dad said, no, his ticker just got tired and stopped working. And the denial, you know, he couldn't even consider the possibility that there might be a connection. And I could understand that, because by that time, my dad had manufactured and sold more ice cream than any human being who had ever lived on the planet. He didn't think that the family product was harming anybody. Didn't want to think that. Couldn't bear to think that. But I had to ethically consider that possibility.
Okay.
And an ice cream cone isn't going to hurt anybody, but the more you eat, the more likely you are statistically,
right,
to have a heart attack or to develop diabetes like my dad did. And if you're manufacturing and selling ice cream, you want people to eat as much as possible.
And of course, I mean, that we are. I'm as a occasional ice cream cone eater myself. I mean, I think that that's the key word. It's just moderation. If you have the occasional ice cream cone, just like if you have the occasional beer, or just like if you enjoyed the occasional cigar, none of these things would have the devastating effect on the human body that prolonged and persistent use would.
Absolutely. And the reason I walked away from Baskin Robbins and the money that it represented is because I felt that our whole way of life is utterly unsustainable. And we're now faced with a disaster in the Gulf of Mexico of truly biblical proportions that illustrates the ultimate unsustainability of what has been our entire way of life.
Well, and that is a connection that occasionally came back to me when I was reading your story, although I couldn't go to the extremes, I don't think, that you could. But I enjoyed reading about when you decided to walk away, brother, you walked away.
I mean, yes, I did. Yes,
I mean, that again, it wasn't a question of like walking away moderately. You leave, you kind of renounce your family fortune at a fairly early age.
Well, I made a choice for integrity. I wanted to live by my own values, and so I told my dad I didn't want to depend on his financial achievements, prodigious though they were. And so I went and lived a very different life and have.
At what age did you start to do that?
21.
So at 21, you know, like a lot of 21-year-olds, you told your father, hey, man, I'll make it on my own. I don't need your money.
Yes,
I don't need your...
Yes.
I mean, we've heard that a million times. I never said it, but my dad didn't have any money, so there was no point in me ever saying it. But in this case, you said it, and then you meant it. And we'll talk about what choices were that John Robbins made, the son of the founder of Baskin Robbins. What were the life-changing decisions that he made? He made then with his wife, and also then children. And then that starts the discussion of then what is the new good life, living better than ever in an age of less. If you're in a situation of less, or if you're planning on trying to get by on less, we'll give you a new high bar for what low consumption means. Does that make sense? A high bar for low consumption. Coming up in just a second. Living better than ever in the age of less. And then coming up next hour on Coast to Coast, we'll roll back the curtain on Big Pharma in a very scary way on Coast to Coast. So I ran the numbers there just so that you could connect with John Robbins before the top of the hour. We might get a call or two, can't promise many, but I know he's got a lot of fans. Not just because of the way in which he tries to get people to live better, but also now live longer and to live in a way which is means having very few objects to will at the end of one's life. Less stuff for the garage sale. John Robbins will talk about the new good life, living better than ever in the age of less, coming up in just a minute. If you want to take a call on that, we can probably squeeze it in. I want to give a shout-out to somebody, and that's to Major Nelson of the Colorado Civil Air Patrol. Did I get that right, Major Nelson? And I know you hear this all the time, but say hi to Dr. Bellows for me. Tell him to get off your case, man. Tell him I said get off your case. And we'll get to both to this topic and then coming up next hour, the subject of Big Pharma. Just what is the extent? How far will a pharmaceutical company go to increase their profits by increasing our ill health? Is it true that some pharmaceutical companies would prefer to keep us sick and keep using their product at an enormous rate? Would they prefer that we just get better and stop using their stuff? One guest coming up next hour was the former head of one of those big companies, and he says, unfortunately, it's all about keeping us sick, not getting us better. That's coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I'm talking with John Robbins, who's known as the author of the big-selling book, Diet for a New America, which was probably, was the last time you were on Coast to Coast was for that, wasn't it?
Well, I've been on several times.
Well, but it was for the idea of living very long.
Yeah, it was healthy at 100, yes.
Okay, right, healthy at 100. I'm sorry, that's what I was trying to figure out. And that too is a great idea, the idea that we could live not just longer, because that's easy, because a lot of, you know, sometimes, I mean, we're all getting where our life expectancy goes up all the time, but to live healthy at 100, that's the tricky part, isn't it?
Yes, it's extending our health span. Just extending the lifespan without a healthy experience is not worthwhile.
No. And we all know of cases where, through advances in medicine, they were able to keep the beating heart in a living corpse for a very long time. But what's the point of that?
What is the point of the old good life has been about pursuing, it's been shot till the planet drops. It's been about obsessing about our net worth and acquiring stuff, whether or not we really need it. And in the new good life, we have to decouple our economy from oil. And we've got to re-engineer our lives to adapt to a world of growing energy scarcity. And that means learning to live using less energy, less oil, less fossil fuels, and to create a quality of life that doesn't depend on a standard of living that is completely unsustainable.
You're one of the few people out there that aren't demanding other people live up to the, you know, to their own standards without doing it themselves. You didn't just buy some carbon offsets, you know.
No.
You actually went in a fairly radical way. At least I don't know that I could do what you did.
Well, I'm not asking anybody to do what I've done, but I have tried to be a pioneer to stretch the envelope and see how far it can go. And in terms of living a life that's thriving, but within my own means and within nature's means, because the way that we have built our prosperity on cheap oil, we're not going to be able to do that any longer. And those who continue to seek that are going to be in for a rude awakening.
See, and my plan was to build my prosperity on cheap ice cream. That was my That's my whole plan. And you've dashed two of my plans.
Well, I'm sorry.
But explain how you did it, because you didn't just say, you know, see ya to the Baskin Robbins, you know, ice cream fortune. You lived it in the sense that you decided to go out and make this life for yourself. So explain how you lived and how you lived with your wife.
Well, I was young then.
Right. I get
it. And we moved to a little island, and we built a very remote place. We built a one-room log cabin, and we lived there for 10 years, growing most of our own food, almost all of it. Our son was born in that log cabin. And we were homesteaders, and we were trying to weave ourselves back into the web of life, trying to send our roots down into the natural world and get out of what Henry Miller had called the air-conditioned nightmare.
Right. But this is really key, that you weren't living on some tropical island.
No, we were actually in British Columbia, Canada.
Yeah. That's not what people think of when they think about island living off the coast of BC.
No, but there's a lot of beautiful islands up there, and we were on one of them.
Oh, that's great. But you were that meant that you had to really plan ahead. It wasn't like you had a 52-week growing cycle.
No, it was a pretty short season, and we were naive and idealistic and made a lot of mistakes, and we learned from them. I think that's sometimes the secret to life, is to learn from your own mistakes so that you don't repeat them. And then you can learn from different mistakes.
What was the worst mistake you made when you became a homesteader on this island in a one-room cabin, kind of? What was the first big mistake you made?
Well, I think the worst one was we got a book of wild edible plants, and it said that skunk cabbage was edible, but it said that the Native Americans used to boil it in water and pour off the water 3 or 4 times before they ate it. And I was a know-it-all, and I had read Adele Davis, and I thought, well, that's going to waste all the water-soluble vitamins and other nutrients that are water-soluble. So I thought, well, we'll just lightly steam it and then eat it. Ha! Well, we did, and it's horribly caustic if you do that, and it's a good thing we didn't kill ourselves. But we made lots of mistakes, but what we did learn was that it is possible to live a healthy life, a life of real quality, of depth, of meaning, of power, of passion and creativity, without depending on continually acquiring more stuff and consuming more stuff and buying into this consumer trance by which so many people are imprisoned today. And that's really, I want to help people find solid ground in the economy to come. Because the assumptions of our economic life thus far aren't credible any longer. You know, it's been the case, it's been a tenet of the American faith, really, that if you worked hard and you showed up and you cooperated and you were honest, you could count on a decent life and maybe putting your kids through college and having a retirement and taking care of your family. But the economy has deteriorated to the point that assumption isn't valid any longer. And in the new economy that we're moving into, we're going to have to be much lighter on our feet and much more creative. But what the reason I wrote The New Good Life is to help people find solid ground in this coming time.
So the idea, too, that if you live to be 100, you don't have to, and this is this is connections I'm making, you can uncouple this, or if this was in a part of the book I didn't get to yet, pardon me for repeating it as though I came up with it, but that you could live to be 100, but you wouldn't have to have made all of the resources between, say, in your 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s that are supposed to sustain you in your 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, that you could reduce what you need and not just live healthy to 100, but also not have to be worried till you're 100 on how you're going to pay for stuff.
Well, I think you can focus on what you need and reduce the extraneous desires. You know, to be able to distinguish between wants and needs is an incredibly empowering thing, and it's liberating. Now, there are forces that don't want you to do that. You know, when large numbers of people willingly participate in their own brainwashing, then blatantly totalitarian government isn't necessary.
Okay.
But when we, as people, as communities, can distinguish between wants and needs and really meet our needs solidly, but not get lost in trying ever more to satisfy extraneous needs that are imposed into us, really, by advertising.
All right.
And by the consumer culture. Then we have our freedom.
But I have to ask you then the paradoxical question. It begs to be asked. Is the purchase of your book, The New Good Life, a want or a need?
Well, what I hope is that it serves people in making that distinction so that they can live closer to the heart of their lives and more in touch with what is essential. And in that sense, it becomes a bridge to deep needs.
And I'm not trying to be obnoxious here, but I'm saying so that buy The New Good Life and then find out afterward whether the purchase of it was for a want or for a need.
Well, I think it is a need to find our way back to our centers and to relieve ourselves from the pressures of needs that aren't really needs, of thinking they're needs. But, you know, advertising is very sophisticated at making us feel as though we need that new sweater. We need the latest cell phone. We need the flat screen TV. We need the brand new car. But we don't need those things. We need healthy lives. We need connections to our families and our friends and our relationships to thrive. We need to experience ourselves as gracious and inspired and clear and solid grounded people.
Well, and I think the one thing you didn't mention there, and I know you do in the book, is time. We need more time to be able to spend with the people that we value and the things that we value doing.
Absolutely.
And that's what The New Good Life, as I read, every paragraph to me spoke to time.
Yes, and you know how much we waste our time in a make-waste society, earning the money to buy things that we don't really need, that don't really serve our spirits, that don't serve our unfolding. And, you know, there's a way that the consumer trance, one of the ways that it imprisons us is it makes us think that our self-worth is just a matter of our net worth, that how much money we have is a statement of the value of us. And, you know, if you want to really lock people out of themselves, if you want to alienate people from themselves so you could control them, what better way would there be than to make them feel that only those with big money are worthy, are valuable, and that the rest of us don't count?
Or that in a democracy, only the people with a lot of money should get a vote. And I think that also speaks to this emphasis on having a lot gives you more influence. And I don't believe that's should be the basis of a successful society. Let me ask you, and then I'm going to get a couple of calls that are waiting for you here. We're talking with John Robbins, The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less. If you had to give a description, a thumbnail of what you think, just kind of a ballpark, broad strokes idea of what people's lives would look like if they followed your advice, what would it look like? What kind of house would they be in? What would their life be like?
Well, their house would be more like a nest and less like a warehouse. And it wouldn't be full of extra stuff that you don't use. It would be naturally elegant. It would have probably solar panels on it to generate the electricity, so you wouldn't be dependent on the grid. It would have compost toilets, if possible, or some form of waste disposal that was ecological, and it would have food growing nearby, perhaps your own garden, perhaps a community garden that you could partake in or from, so that you had local connections to food sources, to energy sources, rather than depending on energy and food brought from very great distances. Because in the economy to come, the economy we're moving into, distance is going to be costly. We've depended on cheap oil to the extent that we could ship things all over the place and bring energy from great distances and food from great distances. That's not going to be possible in the days to come. So what I'm asking people to do is to prepare for that, to be prudent, to be thoughtful, to be conscientious in creating lives that aren't so dependent on cheap oil. We aren't going to have it.
The New Good Life. Let's get a couple of calls. We'll start with Ken in Winnipeg, Canada, for John Robbins on Coast to Coast. Ken? Hey, Ken, you had a question for John Robbins? I'm not hearing Ken.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Go ahead, Ken.
Oh, okay. Just a quickly, a pleasure to speak with both of you.
Thank
I agree
you.
With virtually all of what you say, Mr. Robbins. My wife has far more, I guess, knowledge on you than I do. But my question is this. You had mentioned energy and our reliance on oil. The difficulty is how, and it's more of a question, is how are we supposed to remove ourselves from it when all of the other potential energy sources that are available to us are also controlled?
Well, you know, it's going to be a phasing. It's not going to be one step. And if we can use the energy supplies and the fossil fuels that we're burning now to transition, rather than simply to just business as usual on steroids and polluting extravagantly, as we're seeing in the Gulf, that's the direction. We've got to make that shift. We just have to. We're going to see a world, again, of triple-digit oil prices. And distance is suddenly going to cost money and lots of it. Maybe what we're going to find out is some of the high-paying manufacturing jobs that we thought we had lost forever to cheap labor markets overseas, they may come back. They may come home. But we're going to need to, for example, with your transportation needs, if you can live in a place such that you are less car dependent, and if you need a car, you get a car that's very fuel efficient. That's a step in the right direction. If you can walk, if you can bicycle, if you can get maybe an electric bike, if you can get a motorcycle even, those things can get you where you need to go in some places, and so that you don't need cars so much. Gas is going to become way more expensive in the years to come. And those of us who are driving gas guzzlers, are going to find ourselves in economically exhausted by them.
I was just hearing the other day about how the new Mustang, or more specifically, in my imagination, the new Mustang convertible, it got like the highest rating for miles per gallon of any car.
It's the first car ever made that had over 300 horsepower, has 305, that also gets better than 30 miles to the gallon.
I'm
so 330 car.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty.
It shows you what technology can do when we don't have to give up the things that we enjoy in life, other than those that are exhausting us financially, that are bankrupting us, and that are polluting the planet. If we can stay with the things, the pleasures and the joys and the connections that really help us to thrive in the new economy, in a way that respects ourselves and respects each other and respects the natural world, that's the new good life.
Is the perfect way to end that part. Let me ask you about something else real quickly about the Bernie Madoff connection to your life.
Bernie Madoff is a psychopath.
Right.
And his investment scheme, I got caught up in it through three people distant from me. I didn't ever know who Bernie Madoff was, but we lost a lot of money to his fraud.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, but again, a reminder, perhaps, of the necessity from staying at a good, solid place, the new good life. John Robbins, thank you so much for being a great guest, and look forward to having you back on again sometime in the future on Coast to Coast.
Thank you.
Coming up, another guy who's lived it. He didn't just talk the talk. He's walked the walk, and he walked the walk right out the door at Eli Lilly, former, pharmaceutical executive who couldn't live with knowing what he knew about what was happening inside the pharmaceutical industry. And he's here to tell us, he insists that Big Pharma does not care to make us well. They care to keep us just sick enough to keep making money off us, and he says he can prove it. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.